today, I always say that it seems like when I introduce people to this class, you're in for a real treat, and in this case, you really are. When Aaron Rierson came to give his job seminar, it was one of the best seminars I had seen. It was so interesting that I went home and told my wife that I really hope we hire this guy because he's very charismatic, does really interesting work. He's a behavioral ecologist, but he really has a diverse background. He's published numerous articles in a very short time, basically since 2002. He's received funding from the National Geographic and also been featured on at least two of their documentaries. Unfortunately, he won't be including any video today, but you can probably find him on the web. He started out in Idaho, did his master's on snowshoe hare, so he's come a long way, as you can imagine, starting out in Idaho and then moving to Australia and then back to Florida and now here in Washington. So he did his PhD at Simon Fraser University, interestingly here, but did most of the research in Australia. So he's just started here in September, I think you'll really enjoy his talk. There'll be plenty of time for questions. As you know, we'll try to have everything wrapped up so that you can leave at 9:20. So without any further ado, thank you, Aaron, and enjoy.
Okay, good morning. Can everybody hear me just fine? Everybody can see just fine? All right, let's go ahead and get going then. Thank you very much, Christian, for that warm introduction and setting me up for the big fall. And I'd like to thank Debbie Livingston as well for extending me the invite to participate in this Water Center Seminar Series. I'm really pleased to have this opportunity. Now, in the 3 years prior to my appointment here in the College of Forest Resources, I had the good fortune to participate in the Florida Coastal Everglades Long-Term Ecological Research Project funded by the National Science Foundation, in particular on an effort to elucidate the ecological roles of bull sharks using the Shark River estuary in the Everglades wetland. And the story I'm going to tell you today, I think, represents one of our more interesting findings out of that study to date. And I realize that the topic of my talk, the trophic ecology of bull sharks, might not be entirely consistent with what you're used to hearing here in the water seminar, but I hope that you nevertheless find it interesting and compelling. Before I get going, because the results I'm going to give to you are really the product of a team effort, I feel compelled to acknowledge my chief collaborators in this effort. They are Professors Michael Heithouse and Craig Lehman of the Marine Biology Program at Florida International University, as well as two of Dr. Heithouse's graduate students, Brian Delius here holding a juvenile bull shark, and Megan Dunphy-Daly. So predators can induce numerous direct and indirect effects in food webs, and most studies of these predator effects to date have used a species-based approach. In other words, they've considered individuals within any particular predator species to have the same trophic niche or to exhibit the same network of trophic interactions as defined by Charles Elton in 1927. This species-based approach, as opposed to an individual-based approach, could mask important variation in the way predator individuals within any species affect community and ecosystem properties. For example, although killer whales overall don't prey very heavily on sea otters, most don't prey at all on sea otters, a recent study by Williams et al. In 2004 found that just 5 killer whale individuals switching their diets primarily from pinnipeds or seals and sea lions to sea otters may have triggered dramatic declines in sea otter populations that ultimately led to the collapse of kelp ecosystems in the Northeast Pacific, as documented by Estes et al. In 1998. So clearly, there's great need for additional studies addressing the possibility that top-down predator effects might vary as a function of individual differences in trophic interactions or in trophic ecology in predator species. The first step in conducting these types of studies is to document among individual trophic niche variation in a particular predator species. And for the next 30 minutes or so, I'm going to describe to you our discovery of such among individual trophic niche variation in juvenile bull sharks using an undeveloped subtropical estuary, namely the Shark River estuary in Everglades National Park. For those of you who don't know, the bull shark is a broadly distributed species. It's found in the shallow waters of most of the tropical and subtropical portions of the world's oceans. It's a very large species, with mature adults reaching lengths of up to 3.4 meters, translates to about 11 feet. They're also a very robust, chunky species. They kind of look like a truncated, pug-nosed version of a great white shark. Like the great white shark, they also have a broad diet that incorporates a number of different bony fishes or teleosts, as well as marine mammals and other sharks, including smaller members of their own species. They are cannibalistic. But of course, the bull shark is most popular, and you probably know it because it does pose a very real threat to humans, at least in relation to other large sharks. Indeed, in terms of overall number of attacks as well as fatalities, bull sharks rate as the most dangerous shark to human, even though, again, even for bull sharks, attacks are very rare. One of the reasons that bull sharks pose such a threat to humans is that they are urehaline. In other words, they exhibit a broad salinity tolerance. They can be found all the way from marine environments to fully freshwater environments. In fact, they can travel far into freshwater systems. Bull sharks have been caught up to thousands of kilometers upriver in the Amazon in South America, the Zambezi in Africa, and even some North American rivers. In fact, it was a series of attacks perpetrated on humans by bull sharks in the New England River that originally spawned the Jaws story. So great white sharks got the blame for the Jaws attacks, but it was bull sharks that did the dirty work. So unfair treatment of the great white shark. Female bull sharks venture into estuaries and freshwater systems to pup, and that makes a lot of sense because in these systems, pups are free from the predation risk they might experience in more open ocean habitats. After being born, neonate and juvenile bull sharks continue to spend a lot of their time in these freshwater systems, often traveling far upstream. Now, it's not completely known why these juveniles and neonates spend such a long time in the freshwater systems, often the first 10 to 15 years of their life, until they reach sexual maturity. But one explanation that I think is quite valid is they do so to continue to benefit from the sort of safety that these freshwater systems confer. Larger bull sharks and other large sharks don't tend to be very far upriver in most estuarine systems. Therefore, by continuing to use estuaries, juveniles may enjoy a level of safety they wouldn't if they spent more time out in the open ocean. And again, I think this explanation has a lot of merit, but we thought maybe it wasn't the full story. Maybe there was more to the story of juvenile bull sharks using the upriver portions, the freshwater portions of estuaries. We thought there might also be the possibility that these juveniles do a lot of feeding while they're up there, as opposed to just using it as a safe haven from predation. So our main questions then were, do juvenile bull sharks feed on freshwater resources while upstream in estuaries? And if so, is there individual variation with respect to this tendency? We sought to answer these questions by establishing bull shark fishing and sampling sites along the Shark River estuary. The Shark River estuary, as you can see, emanates from the Gulf of Mexico along the western side of the Florida coastal Everglades inside the national park, and it travels in-stream for about 30 or so kilometers. We wanted our sampling sites to cover the entire span of the river, so we established one sampling site down at the mouth. That was kind of our reference sampling site, a marine site, very characteristic of conditions out in the Gulf of Mexico, very saline water, with the full community of organisms that would be found a little bit farther offshore. We then had a downstream site about 5 kilometers in, and this site was still highly saline, but of course much more confined into a stream. A mid-estuarine site, maybe about 15 kilometers in, that was trending much more towards freshwater. And finally, an upstream site about 20 to 26 kilometers in-stream, which was really representative of a freshwater system. Virtually no salinity there. So a freshwater community existing in the upstream system. Now, we fished for bull sharks and caught bull sharks at each of these four sampling sites using a roughly 500-meter long line equipped with 50 Mustad-sized 12-0 tuna circle hooks equipped with mullet, baited with mullet. We sampled each of the four sites with these long lines evenly across all the four sites, as well as across the two seasons that predominate the Everglades. The Everglades is not a four-season environment. It's a subtropical two-season environment, predominantly wet season in the summer and dry season in the winter. At any particular site, long lines were deployed from dawn to dusk, so we fished them all day, with each a soak time for any particular long line to plummet being about an hour. So we drop the hooks in the water, allow the bait to soak for an hour, then pull the line in and check all the hooks for an occupant. If we didn't catch anything, then we would just redeploy the long line and fish for another hour. But if we were lucky enough to get a bull shark, as pictured here, then we process the animal immediately, taking about 15 minutes, and then release them as fast as possible. And I'm proud to report that thus far over the course of this investigation, which is ongoing, all animals caught have been released in a healthy, vigorous condition. So when we did catch a bull shark, we brought it alongside the boat, as pictured here. We then equipped its dorsal fin with a numbered roto tag for later identification, so we'd be lucky enough to recapture the animal. We measured it, documenting its total length, basically the tip of its nose, the tip of its tail, stretched out, and sexed the animal. And then finally, we collected a muscle tissue sample using a biopsy punch from each individual. These punches collected about a half centimeter squared of tissue lateral to the first dorsal fin. And importantly, these muscle samples were then used to generate stable carbon and nitrogen isotopic signatures for each of the individual bull sharks we caught. Briefly, stable isotopic analysis has become a popular means to provide time and space integrated representations of the trophic ecology or feeding habits of different consumers. For example, ratios of heavy to light nitrogen isotopes, or 15 to 14N, often abbreviated as delta 15N, exhibit stepwise enrichment with trophic transfers up food chains and therefore can be used to estimate relative trophic position within a system. Ratios of heavy to light carbon isotopes, on the other hand, or delta, or 13 to 12C, delta 13C for short, vary greatly among primary producers in different systems, for example, in a marine versus a freshwater system, but not greatly with trophic transfers, and therefore can serve to identify the ultimate source of dietary carbon for any consumer, where it's been doing its feeding. So in other words, these carbon ratios can serve to identify an organism's trophic niche, or the food web where it derives most of its resources. Bull shark muscle tissue exhibits a tissue turnover rate on the order of hundreds of days. That means that bull shark tissue tells you what that animal's been eating over a very large amount of time. Therefore, you can use isotopic nitrogen and carbon signatures from bull shark muscle tissue to identify long-term differences in individual resource use. In other words, to distinguish between animals feeding predominantly in freshwater versus marine food webs. With these isotopic signatures in hand, we then use ANOVA to test for the effects of bull shark length, sex, season, and capture location on isotopic nitrogen and carbon signatures. Now remember, our primary goal here was to determine the extent to which juvenile bull sharks feed while in the Shark River estuary feed in freshwater versus marine food webs. Accordingly, we defined the entire range of isotopic carbon signatures characterizing all other producers and consumers in this system existing solely in freshwater or marine food webs. So we completely defined the freshwater and marine food webs in this system. This process enabled us to establish isotopic carbon boundaries or food web endpoints, marine and freshwater food web endpoints along the entire carbon continuum in the system, if you will, to distinguish between individual bull sharks feeding exclusively in marine or freshwater food webs from those deriving resources from both food webs. In other words, from those exhibiting a mixed diet. So in other words, this process enabled us to distinguish bull sharks with a specialized trophic niche, either feeding in freshwater or marine systems, from those with a generalized trophic niche, feeding both on freshwater and marine resources. Remember, those carbon signatures can allow you to do that distinguishing. So, for example, on this schematic here depicting these isotopic carbon boundaries between exclusive feeding in freshwater food webs, exclusive feeding in marine food webs, the two endpoints, or the intermediate range of carbon values signifying feeding on resources in both food webs, an individual bull shark with an isotopic carbon ratio falling within the region now shaded in light blue would be able to be comfortably assigned exclusively to a freshwater food web. In other words, we could deduce from that signature, the extremely depleted nature of that signature, that that animal had been deriving most, if not all, of its resources from freshwater sources. On the other hand, an individual with an isotopic signature falling within this intermediate range of carbon values, now highlighted in blue, would be able to be comfortably assigned to the mixed trophic niche. In other words, a trophic niche entailing reliance on resources from both freshwater and marine food webs, a mixed diet. And of course, if we found the value on the other end of the spectrum, we would assign the animal to the marine trophic niche. So this process of distinguishing bull sharks, the feeding history of bull sharks, was conducted using an exhaustive search of the literature that enabled us to paint the full picture of each of the two food webs in the system, as well as samples from our own analysis where we needed to fill in gaps. And I should note that this exhaustive search of the literature was facilitated by the tremendous amount of work done by our colleagues as part of the Florida Coastal Everglades Ecological Research Project. All right, so when the dust settled from all this analysis, what did we find? Well, all told, we collected muscle tissue samples from about 79 individual juvenile bull sharks. And this represented quite a sample. In fact, our sample of isotopic values was the largest reported for any elasmobranch, at least to our knowledge. The sizes of the juvenile bull sharks we caught range from about 72 to 190 centimeters total length. It's a fairly broad range of sizes, but all these animals fell comfortably within the juvenile age class. And our captured sample exhibited roughly a 1-to-1 sex ratio, same number of males and females. So the first thing we did was look at the mean isotopic carbon and nitrogen signatures of all the animals we caught at the four capture sites. Let's first consider stable isotopic nitrogen, which, remember, helps to establish trophic position within a system. We found no significant variation in stable isotopic nitrogen signatures with respect to any of our explanatory variables, length, sex, season, wet versus dry, or site. So let's look at that graphically. Here we have an isotopic nitrogen-carbon biplot. You'll see these a lot in the literature. On the y-axis, we have increasing values of isotopic nitrogen ratios. These correspond to increasingly high positions, trophic positions within the system. So higher numbers equal a higher trophic position. On the x-axis, we have isotopic carbon values. And remember, these serve to identify the ultimate source of dietary carbon for a consumer. Very small depleted values indicate very heavy, if not exclusive, reliance on freshwater resources, whereas very enriched values indicate heavy, if not exclusive, reliance on marine resources. Now, in this figure, and the one I'm going to show you next, red symbols correspond to all producers and consumers in the system residing exclusively in the freshwater food web. Okay, so this is the freshwater community here. They have signatures corresponding to sourcing or producing carbon only in the freshwater system. Blue symbols, on the other hand, correspond to the full range of producers and consumers existing solely in the marine food web in the system. Juvenile bull sharks, the four capture sites, are indicated by the green boxes. Okay, so let's first consider isotopic nitrogen here. We can see that irrespective of capture location, the juvenile bull sharks we caught all exhibited a very similar isotopic nitrogen signature when averaged across site. And this signature placed them relatively high, at a relatively high trophic position within the community. And that's exactly what we would expect. Okay? Juvenile bull sharks are expected to be an upper level secondary consumer in this system. So nothing too surprising there. No great variation across sampling site. All bull sharks manifesting a very similar trophic position within the system. Slightly different story, however, emerged when we looked at isotopic carbon values for our bull sharks. We again found no significant variation in stable carbon isotope signatures with respect to length, sex, or season. But we did find that juvenile bull sharks caught at the mouth of the estuary were significantly more carbon-enriched, in other words, more marine, than those caught at sites farther upstream. So let's again revisit that nitrogen-carbon biplot. Remember again, now we're going to be focusing on the carbon axis here, the x-axis, which indicates whether animals are residing within freshwater, marine food webs, or both. Again, red symbols represent the span of the freshwater community, and blue symbols represent the span of the marine community. Juvenile bull sharks are the green boxes. Now here you can see there is a little bit of variation with respect to study site in isotopic carbon signatures of juvenile bull sharks. In particular, individuals caught at the mouth exhibit a more enriched mean signature relative to individuals caught farther upstream. There's no difference between the other three sampling sites. What this means is that individual juvenile bull sharks caught at the mouth of the estuary rely more heavily on marine resources than conspecifics caught farther upstream. So they have a trophic niche characterized by heavy reliance on marine resources, Whereas animals upstream exhibit a trophic niche characterized by a mixed diet, reliance on resources from both the freshwater and marine food web. Okay? So we have two different trophic niches emerging here. Kind of interesting. But is this the end of the story? Well, not quite. Remember earlier that we were particularly interested in individual signatures, not mean signatures. So we wanted to look a little bit more closely at these data, to look at the individual spread, the spread of individual signatures, as opposed to just pooling them, these carbon signatures, as opposed to just pooling them across a study site. And that's what's depicted in this figure here. So this is another nitrogen-carbon biplot, but here the symbols correspond only to bull sharks, each symbol being an individual bull shark that we caught. Okay. So again, on the x-axis here, we have the range of carbon values, with depleted values corresponding to freshwater resource use, enriched values corresponding to marine resource use. And the individual bull sharks are color-coded according to capture location, with blue diamonds being animals caught at the river mouth, red squares being animals caught mid-estuary, and purple circles being animals caught upstream. The two shaded regions are very important. Those are our food web endpoints that we calculated earlier. In other words, they're the complete range of isotopic carbon values characterizing animals residing exclusively in marine or freshwater food webs. So if an individual bull shark signature falls within one of these shaded regions, we can comfortably assign that animal to a different approach. We can assign it to an exclusively marine diet, an exclusively freshwater diet, or a mixed diet here in white. Now, as you can see, there's a tremendous amount of variability with respect to carbon signatures across all these individual bull sharks. Once again, if we look at individuals, most of the blue diamonds, the animals we caught at the river mouth, do exhibit a trophic carbon signature that would be characterized by an animal relying heavily, if not exclusively, on marine resources. So not much variability there. But there's tremendous scatter among animals caught mid-estuary and upriver, with some being exhibiting a completely marine diet, and many others exhibiting signatures indicating that they were deriving their nourishment exclusively from freshwater food webs. So as we looked at individual signatures here, what we began to find is that there were not two, but three different trophic niches. Some individuals that got masked by our mean analysis now ended up exclusively feeding in the freshwater food web in the Shark River estuary. So to summarize then, our exploration of individual signatures as opposed to mean carbon signatures revealed not two, but three different trophic niches, three different networks of trophic interactions. A specialized trophic niche entailing heavy, if not exclusive, reliance on marine resources. A generalized trophic niche entailing a mixed diet or reliance on resources from both freshwater and marine food webs. And another specialized trophic niche entailing heavy, if not exclusive, reliance on freshwater resources. And remember, importantly, this second specialized trophic niche would have been entirely missed had we relied on mean signatures. We only had the two. We had the mixed diet and the marine. This freshwater niche emerged only when we took account of the entire range of individual signatures and found that some were incredibly depleted, indicating they were feeding pretty much exclusively on freshwater prey. So let's look at the distribution of these trophic niches. They're color-coded, with blue corresponding to the marine trophic niche, green corresponding to the mixed trophic niche, and red corresponding to the freshwater trophic niche. Here we have again our sampling sites along the Shark River estuary. At the mouth, as I've been saying before, we observed a predominance of the marine trophic niche. Most of the animals caught down there were relying heavily, if not exclusively, on marine resources. And that makes sense. Remember, that was kind of our reference sampling point. The river mouth really is very consistent with the community out in the Gulf of Mexico. So we fully expected juveniles caught there to be feeding on marine resources. But the interesting picture emerges as we travel upstream. We see that at each of those three upstream sampling sites, we witnessed all three trophic niches, all three ways of making a living from the standpoint of feeding, with animals with marine signatures being found all the way upstream, as far as 26 kilometers upstream. So there's very little spatial segregation once you go inside the estuary with respect to these three different trophic niches. Instead, individuals exhibiting these very different dietary lifestyles were existing in sympatry. So as a general summary then, we found that juvenile bull sharks in the Shark River estuary manifest three different trophic niches, or networks of trophic interactions. Two of these niches are specialized niches entailing heavy, if not exclusive, reliance on marine or freshwater resources. In other words, bull sharks exhibiting two of these niches were pretty much existing trophically within one of two food web endpoints, a marine food web or a freshwater food web. Whereas other individuals in the same area, using the same habitats, exhibited a trophic niche entailing a mixed diet, reliance on resources from both marine and freshwater food webs. And this freshwater trophic niche would have been missed had we not focused on individuals. And that's I keep pointing that out because most studies do tend to pool isotopic values. They tend to group them and put more credence in those groupings as opposed to looking at the range. This pattern of trophic niche variation was not explained well by size, sex, or seasonal fluctuation, right? Differences in isotopic carbon and nitrogen signatures did not correspond well with the size of the bull sharks we caught, their sex, or wet and dry season. Nor is it explained that well by capture location or space use. Now, there was a preponderance of the marine niche downriver, but as soon as we went inside the estuary, there was very little spatial segregation across the three trophic niches. Instead, we had animals exhibiting the three different lifestyles living in sympatry, living side by side. So if these factors can't do a good job of explaining why we see these three distinct trophic niches, then what is the explanation? Well, that's hard to say and is going to require more research, but I can speculate that it probably has something to do with the trade-off. The ultimate source of this differentiation in diets has to do with the trade-off. A recent paper by Bolnick et al. In 07 suggested that intraspecific variation in trophic niches can stem from the existence of a unique set of trade-offs being associated with each distinct niche. And I think this is the case for juvenile bull sharks in the Shark River. For juvenile bull sharks, the marine river mouth is resource-rich. There's a plenitude of fishes and other species they can rely on there. Okay, food is ample. But the river mouth is also dangerous. Remember, I mentioned earlier that larger bull sharks like to prey on juvenile bull sharks. And there are other big sharks, like lemon sharks, that use the river mouth, that use the sort of marine portions of estuaries. So juvenile bull sharks feeding there are exposing themselves to very high risk of predation. Inside the wet estuary, on the other hand, in particular as you move upstream, resources become scarcer and scarcer. But at the same time, predation risk gets lower and lower because large sharks are pretty disinclined from going all the way upstream into the very shallow portions. So what you have here, in summary then, is a situation where the river mouth is resource-rich but dangerous for juvenile bull sharks, whereas upstream portions become increasingly resource-poor but safer. This food safety trade-off would be expected to promote niche diversity by the following mechanism: by allowing some individual bull sharks to exploit limited freshwater resources, remember that freshwater trophic niche, upstream in safety. But heavy competition for these limited resources would force other individuals farther downstream, where they can achieve a greater feeding reward by relying more and more heavily on marine resources, but at a greater risk to their own welfare. Some animals we might expect to move back and forth between the two food webs, whereas others might be able to benefit by spending most of their time feeding on marine resources, but at a great risk of predation. So again, this trade-off between food and safety sets up a situation where basically multiple lifestyles are equally valid, so you can have all three in the same area. Irrespective of its explanation, our finding is important for several reasons. First, it implicates juvenile bull sharks as potentially important vectors or carriers of nutrients into the nutrient-limited upper reaches of the Shark River estuary. Shark River estuary is interesting because it becomes increasingly nutrient-depleted as you go from marine to fresh water. That's the opposite a trend that you see in many other areas. So it's quite possible that juvenile bull sharks feeding on marine resources out in the Gulf of Mexico and then traveling up the river carry important limiting nutrients like phosphorus as they move into these upstream regions where these nutrients are then deposited via excretion or when the juveniles die. And I think further investigation is warranted to determine the importance of juvenile bull sharks carrying these nutrients upstream. Secondly, our results are the first to document among individual trophic niche variation in an elasmobranch rank within an age class. Other studies have shown that as sharks grow larger and move from immaturity to adulthood, their diet can transition. Tiger sharks, for example, go from relying very heavily on other fishes when they're young to relying heavily on marine reptiles like sea turtles, marine mammals, and other sharks when they're large. So we know that. But here we have the first instance of documentation of different, very different diets in animals within the same age class, juveniles. Third, and more generally, our results suggest that any study relying heavily on a small sample of individuals and or focusing on mean isotopic trends versus individual variation could potentially miss or at least underestimate the diverse functional roles that predators play in communities. In our case, for example, had we just relied upon mean isotopic carbon signatures, we would have missed the fact that some sharks in the Shark River estuary were feeding exclusively on freshwater resources and therefore may act as very important predators in a freshwater food web. Our results also have some important implications for conservation. Like other large shark populations, bull shark populations off the waters of Florida appear to be in steep decline due to a combination of targeted fishing, mostly in the past, but continuing levels of bycatch. In fact, in some areas, bull shark populations are down so low there are probably too few individuals to fill the species' former ecological role. In other words, what I'm saying is in many ecosystems, it's been speculated, animals that were once prey for bull sharks probably are operating in a fairly predator-free environment right now. And that's already had consequences for these communities. We can speculate that the complete loss of bull sharks from these offshore waters could lead to substantial marine community reorganization. We know that in a lot of other systems, the loss of a top predator leads to community reorganization, impoverization, sometimes outright ecosystem meltdown. Our results suggest that the loss of bull sharks won't just have an impact in these offshore waters. It's also going to affect the estuary itself because juveniles use the estuary so much. They suggest in particular that if we knock the bull shark population out around the estuary, around the Everglades, we also lose a potentially important vector for nutrients into the upstream regions, and that may impact nutrient dynamics in the nutrient-limited upstream portions of the estuary. We might also lose not only an important marine predator, but also an important freshwater predator far upstream, right? If juveniles are no longer making their way upstream and feeding there on the fishes in these upstream portions, then we no longer have a top predator in those areas. In general, then, our results suggest that the ecological consequences of declines in large predators may be much greater than is appreciated because of the fact that we've used a species-based approach for assessing the trophic ecology of predators in the past. It may very well be that an increased focus on individual patterns of feeding as opposed to species pooling may give us a greater appreciation for the many pathways by which predators influence their communities. For example, in bull sharks, we now know that juveniles influence both marine and freshwater communities. Okay? And an increased appreciation for the multitude of these pathways is going to give us a better ability to predict the many different consequences of removing these top predators from ecosystems. That's all I have to say. I'd like to conclude by acknowledging the logistical support of the National Park Service, Everglades National Park, financial support from the National Science Foundation, and of course, again, the help from the many members of the Florida Coastal Everglades Long-Term Ecological Research Project. Special thanks also go to Derek Burkholder, Katie Cameron, Jim Forkran, Adam Rosenblatt, and Jeremy Votto, without whose help this project never could have come to fruition. And of course, we benefited greatly from help from a variety of other assistants who played very important roles. With that, I'll thank all of you for showing up this morning on this frosty morning, and I'll do my best to answer any questions you have. Thank you very much. Okay, yes?
How difficult do you see creating a system, some kind of a grid that would allow us to take a look at predators, large predators across the whole coastline, let's say on the west side of the United States? I'm sure that's no surprise to you that our concerns are that we're all related all the way, particularly from the Alaska area to California. We have an incredible need for large predator movement and sustainability.
Right. Well,
could you summarize the question?
Oh, yes. The question again was how difficult would it be to establish sort of a large shark ecological monitoring program here on the West Coast, all along the West Coast of North America? And I would say it would be very difficult, particularly because the sort of bathymetry of the West Coast is different from the East Coast. You get a much steeper drop off. Very rapidly, you don't get these sort of broad expanses of shallow water, which facilitate more marine research in the Atlantic versus the Pacific. Irrespective of that, my position is always to advocate the establishment of a series of long-term monitoring programs, catch-and-release monitoring programs. We've had tremendous luck with that, both in the Everglades with bull sharks, as well as in Shark Bay, where I did my PhD work in Western Australia, with tiger sharks. I think the first step is to establish a systematic program of population sampling. We really just don't have, we don't really have that anywhere in North America. There are some areas that have been sort of systematically monitoring shark catch rates, but they have mostly been associated with commercial operations or have been somewhat haphazard over time. I think the crucial beginning step is establishing a series of monitoring stations along the West Coast where we use different types of capture techniques within a scientific framework to monitor population patterns. We can then start combining that with individual behavioral monitoring to sort of build a clearer picture of the population dynamics and behavior of these sharks. But, you know, to answer your original question, it's a very big challenge, which explains why we don't have programs like that before. But I think, again, what my colleagues and I have been arguing for is along both coasts of North America, the establishment of a systematic program entailing similar sampling regimes so we can actually compare numbers in different areas. I think that's absolutely crucial. It's something we lack. I don't know if I'll have the opportunity to contribute to that here on the West Coast, but if the opportunity did arise, I would certainly be willing to engage in that process. Yes?
What I'm interested is in difference. Have you looked at the difference between this, area where there's a high predation versus others, and how they relate to each other?
In terms of the phosphorus cycling? No, that would be a great next step, is to, compare other areas where that are nutrient limited but that don't benefit from bull sharks coming upstream. Is that the question? Was basically, have we been able to compare the shark river system where you have bull sharks coming up and acting as an important predator in these freshwater systems and potentially depositing phosphorus to other areas which don't have bull sharks coming up? And the answer is no. This study was just a first step. It can serve as a nice reference point for comparison. The Shark River is kind of nice because it's a fairly undisturbed area. I mean, there are impacts there. It's certainly not pristine. I think it still nevertheless serves as a good reference point. So our next step would be to hopefully compare it to other areas maybe where bull sharks have been more heavily extirpated and we don't have that mode of transport. Another part of that question is to really just determine how important bull sharks are as vectors for phosphorus transport. We've speculated that, we know they carry some phosphorus up, but the next question is how much? How important is the phosphorus they inject into those nutrient-limited upper reaches of the estuary? And that's a part of our ongoing investigation. So I don't have any concrete answers for you right now, unfortunately.
How do you determine whether or not the tags interfere with their behavior?
The dorsal fin tags? Yeah, good question. In all my work with tiger sharks and bull sharks, I don't have any indication thus far that the tags give them a problem. They're tiny little plastic tags that just go on the very tip of the dorsal fin. The tissue there, it's kind of like our fingernail tissue. It just gets kind of deposited on top. They don't really feel any pain with the implantation of the tag. And the tags are very small. So we don't have any really great expectation that it impacts their behavior. We've been tagging bull sharks and tiger sharks for over 10 years now, and we've never garnered any evidence that they affect them. In fact, we very frequently re-catch individuals. The tag looks just fine. So by all indications, we don't think the tagging is affecting them, but we don't have the detailed behavioral monitoring to really assess that. Yes?
Do you have any plans for behavior analysis, like if the top predators near the burrowing mouth are more aggressive, what taking the most aggressive individuals out of the system would do to the entire system?
Okay, so the question was, do we have any plans of removing some of the larger sharks?
No. Okay, so didn't you say that some of the larger sharks near the mouth are being taken away from fishing and stuff like that?
Oh, right, yes. Yeah, bull shark, the adult bull shark population off the coast of Florida has been hammered pretty hard.
So those are the most aggressive individuals possibly?
Well, the large bull sharks offshore pose a threat to juvenile bull sharks. That's the thing. Is once a bull shark, the only thing a bull shark really has to worry about as it's getting larger is a larger bull shark. So once they reach a large enough size and they don't really have any predators, then they become a true top predator. I don't know that large bull sharks are any more aggressive than young ones. They just have a greater capacity to eat other things and become a threat to humans. So undoubtedly, the removal of large bull sharks offshore has had impacts on a lot of other species because you're basically removing danger from the environment. And we know, for example, that in a danger-free environment, and really much of the Caribbean is danger-free at this point. Tiger sharks and bull shark populations have really been decimated there. And that's allowed sea turtles, for example, to graze on seagrass unfettered in the Caribbean. And people love sea turtles. I love sea turtles. But they're running amok out there, and they're overgrazing seagrass beds to the point that they're threatening these really sensitive seagrass communities. So it's kind of made us sort of re-spin our view of the entire system and realize the importance of having that threat of shark predation out there. So I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but certainly having those big, aggressive bull sharks removed offshore has had terrible consequences for these offshore ecosystems. They're kind of artificial. We look at the Caribbean as a natural environment, but it's really not. It's sort of an artificial, predator-free environment. Yes?
So with more of the larger sharks being removed downstream, have you seen more juveniles moving downstream to the mouths of the estuaries?
Oh, that's a super question, but yeah, that's sort of beyond the resolution of our study. But I think if we continue this study on down the road, that would be interesting to explore if we sort of relax the predation risk from other large sharks, including large bull sharks. Does that alter that trade-off? Does it make it more beneficial for juvenile sharks to go downstream? That's certainly a possibility, although, of course, unfortunately, as we decimate the bull shark population offshore, so too do we drop numbers of juveniles in the river, and that decreases pressure on resources. So I think the loss of bull sharks offshore could influence that trade-off in a multitude of ways, and only through long-term research are we going to be able to explore that. But again, this study is ongoing, so maybe someday we'll be able to assess that. The goal, I think, would be to work for another decade or two and really assess that. I think that would give us a better ability to sort of assess the consequences of removing bull sharks altogether, because I think their numbers are going down. One more?
Aaron, I noticed that you're going to be speaking at King Hall, in March, on the future of large carnivores in the Northwest, and the flyer has a beautiful picture of a wolf on it. I was wondering if you could give us a little sneak preview of your talk. And for those of you who are interested, please up calendar online to find Dr. Hirsch's talk. Do you know the date?
March 5. March 5, it's the winter lecture as part of the College of Forest Resources, and it's going to be focusing more on the sort of general large consequences of taking top predators out of ecosystems. I'm going to build up from our long-term work in Shark Bay, Western Australia, where we've been exploring that question with tiger sharks. Our long-term goal there has been to ask, what are the consequences of removing an apex predator from a seagrass ecosystem? Tiger sharks are the only top predator there. They exert myriad effects on consumers, and those then generate indirect effects on the seagrass and fish populations. If you take tiger sharks out, our work has at least suggested that you're going to get a radical restructuring of the entire seagrass ecosystem there. Our findings aren't just relevant to a marine seagrass system, though. They speak, I think, very loudly to the consequences of taking a top predator out of any system. So what that talk is going to do is start with the focus on our work in Australia, but then expand to incorporate the possibilities for predator removal and the return of some predators like wolves for ecosystems here in the Northwest. Because I think that tiger sharks are very analogous to a wolf or a mountain lion, that they're top predators that alter the behavior of a lot of different prey species. They can really be important to the functioning of an ecosystem. If you remove them, you really risk at least ecosystem change, if not, in some cases, ecosystem collapse. And so that's going to be sort of the general thrust of the talk. If you're interested in the issue of the consequences of predator loss, and in some cases return, like wolves recolonizing the state, then I encourage you to come to that talk.
I'll squeeze in a quick question. Do you have tissue samples that are available to look at genetics, so that you could identify potential stocks that are associated with different life history?
Yes. Yes, we do. Yeah, the question was, do we have tissue samples enabling genetic analysis to assess different stocks of bull sharks and other sharks? And we do. Yeah, we take actually a battery of tissue samples. I talked here about muscle. We've also been taking blood and fin clip tissues for isotopic analysis. It's a whole other story, but the signatures from those tissues can differ, and that has some ramifications for the conclusions you might draw as well. But we also take genetic samples, and we're running those right now. And what we're finding is there is a fair bit of spatial differentiation, population structure in the bull sharks. All right, well, thanks so much for coming out. Hope you enjoyed it.